Off the Ball, GAA.
Hugs are not allowed in hurling, lads. Seamus might disagree with me and say it was soft, but he stood him up, but he had his hands around him and he literally hugged him.
Join in the obsession. Subscribe now at offtheball.com/join.
You're listening to OTB's Breakfast Bite.
Yeah! One last question to wrap, Tom. Every time there's been green shoots of an English rugby revival, Scotland have punctured it and sent them home to think again. Are they going to do it again this weekend?
That would be five in a row, Jar, and they've never done five in a row against England. I suspect that England are going to win this. You look at the victories that Scotland have had over England, and it's Duane van der Merwe doing just outrageous things, or Finn Russell or Hugh Jones, tries from the other end of the world, incredible moments. Like if England are done again in those kind of ways for the fifth time, then they really need to have a look at themselves. So Scotland are dangerous. You know, they score those tries against England. They never scored them against Ireland. You know, they can score them against France. They can score them against South Africa, New Zealand on occasion. But they can't score them against Ireland, but they just run them in for fun against England. I mean, Vernon Murphy has scored six tries and Hugh Jones has scored five tries against England in the Six Nations. Those two players have scored more Six Nations tries than any other player in the history against England, in the history of the Six Nations, two Scottish guys. So, yeah, Scotland will cause them problems. Scotland will probably find space. I just think that England's power might tell in the end. I said that last year and the year before that as well, mind you.
Yeah, fool us five times, shame on us, I guess. Has the navel gazing led to Scotland saying, like, why are we so good against England but so bad against Ireland? Has that been the last fortnight?
Yeah, well, it's been a lot of why are we so bad against Ireland? And there are many, many reasons for that. One, because Ireland are just better, right? That's very simple. Ireland are better. They're more powerful. They're more intelligent in problem solving mid game. They're more ruthless. But Scotland underperformed at the same time. I think there's a psychological element here against Ireland. You know, when you lose that many games in a row, all different types of defeats, that's got to have leave a few scars. So I think those scars were there at Murrayfield, and Ireland were just too good. Against England, there's no such fear, you know? There isn't that fear. There hasn't been that fear. To win four times in a row, like Townsend has faced England seven times as Scotland coach. He's lost one game. I mean, it's an extraordinary record, given he's now lost 11 in a row against Ireland.
It's mad.
Amazing, isn't it?
It's absolutely
mad. Yeah, it's mad. It is mad. Yeah, yeah, it is.
There's no logical explanation for it. On the Finn Russell issue, there was speculation, really. Paddy Andrews was in studio yesterday wondering, is he an Andy Farrell type of player or not? And I'm not sure. Is Finn Russell, we were all penciling him in as the starting 10 at the start of the tournament for the Lions, and what a great tournament it would be if he was. But I'm just not, I don't know. Maybe Paddy Andrews is right.
Well, I think if you put Finn Russell behind that Ireland pack, or a Lions pack, you're going to see a very dominant Finn Russell. I think he's every coach's type of player. He should be anyway, because he's world-class. And the bigger and nastier the pack you put in front of him, the more damage he's going to do. I would have said at the start of the Six Nations that he was a shoe-in at 10. He hasn't played particularly well. I know he got injured early on against Ireland, and it's touch and go whether he'll be playing against England. Hopefully he will be. But he hasn't been playing great. And I think Prendergast is closing the gap now. And maybe Finn Smith, but certainly Prendergast is closing the gap. I still think Russell is, I do think he's Andy Farrell's type of player, because he can just create things out of nothing. And I think this notion that he's a maverick, I think that's outdated, you know. Finn Russell is well able to play an Andy Farrell type game, because he's a very, very intelligent and a world-class player.
Hey, buddy, want to go to the dog park? Go with Simparica Trio. It's triple protection made simple. Simparica Trio is the first monthly chewable that covers heartworm disease, ticks and fleas, round and hookworms. This drug class has been associated with neurologic adverse reactions, including seizures. Use with caution in dogs with a history of these disorders. Be sure to tap to read the full prescribing information. Protect him with all your heart. Ask your veterinarian about Simparica Trio. Tap or visit SimparicaTrio.com to learn more.
It's 7 minutes past nine. It is through rugby we're turning. This book is Concussed, Sport's Hidden Truth, and the author is Sam Peters. And I'm delighted to say Sam is with us at probably a very appropriate moment heading into the England-Scotland game this weekend. Sam, good morning to you. How are you?
Yeah, very well, thanks, guys. Good to be on. Thanks for having me on.
You've been writing about the issue of concussion and the culture around head injuries in rugby for a very long time, and it seems as if the story ebbs and flows in terms of how conscious the public are of it, but I suspect over the next couple of years it's going to be impossible for sports journalism and the sport and sports fans to ignore it. So can you maybe just bring us back to the start? What piqued your interest first?
The start for me was really covering the sport, going from playing the game as an amateur growing up, leaving school around 95, 96 when the game went professional, and studying the game really closely and seeing the change in dynamic from professionalism through amateur through professionalism and the changing shape and size and the injury profile of the game that changed then and really sort of tracking that injury profile and tracking the changing risk profile, I suppose, of the professional game.
Was there a trigger specifically where you're like, hang on a second, or is it just a growing recognition that you're meeting so many people who had concussions?
Yeah, I mean, both really. So I covered a number of games, high profile games, where there were players knocked out, sometimes twice in a game. Lewis Moody was one I write about in the book against Tonga in 2007 in Paris in the World Cup. There was the George Smith incident, the Lions in 2013. British and Irish Lions played Australia in Sydney. Clearly suffered a brain injury, but was allowed to play on under, even though they'd introduced new head injury protocols at that point. And it was really, the book is my sort of summary of 10, 12 years writing about this and why the story does, as you say, sort of pops in and out of consciousness when it's simmering underneath. And you've alluded to, I think, the legal case in the next couple of years, which is sort of coming up on the radar and will make this front and centre for rugby again. And, it's a shame it's got to this point.
What I found reading the book, Sam, and listening to you talk about it in other podcasts is, and it definitely felt that way for me, is you wince a lot of the time with the physical detail of some of the concussions. And then the other prevailing theme for me is the attitude towards it in rugby. Just anecdotally, I was talking to a friend of mine last night. I was asking him to remind me of the circumstance. He was playing in a football match in Cork, collided with the goalkeeper, was clearly out of it, was dazed around the pitch. But this was actually around the time when you say it turned, was the 2013 Lions tour, and George Smith going back for Australia. It was around this time the game was played. And long story short, a friend of mine goes home, sees the family dog in the house, as in been there his whole life, goes back out to his dad and says, "Oh, there's a dog in the house." And he's asked what year it is when he goes to the hospital, and he says 6 years earlier. And the thing about it is, a lot of it's like, oh, that's kind of funny. You know, you laugh at those stories. You didn't know he had a dog. But what's striking is that there's medical personnel that you mentioned in the book who present about head injuries in a comical fashion that so alienates people in the room who are impacted by concussion.
Yeah, I mean, I was pretty shocked at the culture once I started sort of scratching the surface, I guess, interviewing players, trying to understand why they found it so funny. It was a reference, I've mentioned Lewis Moody already, but I reference an interview I did with him where he said, described this picture where guys would stand around in training and just laugh at each other, basically how severe was your ding, how strongly had your bell been rung. And it was, there was the language around it, which was very much jovial and jocular, and I tried to understand where that came from. And I write about a conference I attended at Twickenham where a senior sports medic basically presented in a way that I believed, and lots of other people in the room believed, was essentially trivialising the issue, and that culture sort of seeped down. And I'm really fascinated, and have always been fascinated by that sort of conflict that you see between medical staff who are employed by clubs and unions, and also have a responsibility, a duty of care to the players as patients. And a lot of the book is really exploring that tension. I have a lot of sympathy for the medics on the ground in a lot of cases, but I'm fairly critical of some of the senior medics who are sort of dictating culture and policy, I suppose.
Can you give us an example of one of those times when there was medical personnel and that person's delivery of lines associated with concussion?
Yeah, I mean, there was, as I say, I referenced that Twickenham culture, that Twickenham incident. But I mean, so many times I was seeing on the ground, clear protocol breaches where doctors and medics were basically allowing players to play on. It wasn't that complicated. And that was what was frustrating for me, was really the fact that there were clear protocols in place, but they were just being ignored. And it was about unpicking that culture and exploring how that had been allowed to happen. But there's several references in the book where I was bitterly frustrated by some of the actions and the language, I suppose.